bless you for being an angel. Just when it seemed that heaven was not for me.
Hello and welcome to Drunk Church.
I'm Cosima B. Concordia.
And I'm Aurora Layborn.
Today is our second annual Halloween episode, and this time it's going to be on disability. Now, disability is something that anyone that has not yet confronted it in their own lives often is very detached from. But one of the things that disability rights and disability theory has pushed is the idea that we are all just pre-disabled. So health is something that, yes, you may have now, but all of us, eventually our bodies break down mentally. We lose some sort of capabilities, and the ability to be completely self-sufficient and the ability to, you know, do everything perfectly within the set of normalcy within a capitalist framework is always something that is temporary at best. Mm-hmm. And so today we're going to be exploring that framework and specifically going over Susan Sontag's Illness as Metaphor and also our personal histories of disability and how they have affected our own lives and how those things have affected how we see the world and have come to the conclusions in both what we believe and how we live ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Before we launch into Susan Sontag's work, just to root us in a kind of metaphor, and we'll eventually talk about why metaphors are harmful or limiting, is to think about how disability has a bit of a spectral aspect. So the idea of becoming disabled, or the idea of our vulnerability, or the inevitable decline of our mental and physical states haunts us. So it's sort of always on the horizon, and yet something that we're not fully reconciled with. Or when we are forced to confront it, we're forced to confront something very scary about ourselves or about other people.
Mm-hmm. Something that strikes us as very scary, at least before mm-hmm. we're actually in it.
But it's always just the myth of being fully able-bodied, like the myth of being independent, because we're always dependent on someone else. Like, even the fit, able-bodied salary man can only live the life that he's living, like if we're using the stereotype of the American dream, because he has a wife at home cooking all of his meals so he can comfortably go to his 9-to-5 in the office where the thermostat is set to accommodate his 3-piece suit.
Yeah, that's so much of the illusion of being fully able-bodied is through like putting the harder labor onto invisible minorities that we don't even mm-hmm. think about.
Which is, I think, the true horror of disability and the myth of able-bodiedness and able-mindedness, everything that it invisibilizes. Rooting us in Illness as Metaphor, like, I'm just going to read the introduction or some quotes from the introduction, because what she then does is she then explores tuberculosis and cancer as metaphors, but I would like us to be able to move a little bit more freely with the framework that she sets up, just so that we're able to dig a little bit deeper into our own personal experiences and just to really get as much as we can out of this theory. So, illness is the night side of life, a more onerous citizenship. Everyone who is born holds dual citizenship in the kingdom of the well and in the kingdom of the sick. Although we all prefer to use only the good passport, sooner or later, each of us is obliged, at least for a spell, to identify ourselves as citizens of that other place. I want to describe not what it is really like to immigrate to the kingdom of the ill and live there, but the punitive or sentimental fantasies concocted about that situation. Not real geography, but stereotypes of national character. My subject is not physical illnesses itself, but the uses of illness as a figure of metaphor. My point is that illness is not a metaphor, and that the most truthful way of regarding illness, and the healthiest way of being ill, is the one most purified of, most resistant to, metaphorical thinking. Yet it is hardly possible to take up one's residence in the kingdom of the ill unprejudiced by the lurid metaphors with which it has been landscaped. It is toward an elucidation of those metaphors and a liberation from them that I dedicate this inquiry. I think that we're all really guilty of this, of a failure to actually name disability and a failure to name our experiences of disability. So there's always a kind of metaphorical thinking that we use to sanitize our relationship with those experiences, to make them more acceptable to others when we're sharing our narratives, to soften the blow of diagnoses. And it ends up creating, like, on one hand, a lot of really beautiful art. I'm not anti-metaphor, but on the other hand, we risk doublespeak. So we risk creating ever more complicated language that says less and less about what it is that we're trying to articulate.
Hi, Mandu.
Oh, sorry. Mandu. Shh, shh, shh. Hey, baby, baby. Good boy. Good boy. Oh, is there some dog out there? Probably. Very spooky. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Halloween. Okay, hopefully that's it. Sorry, continue where you left off.
So much about disability and disability studies or like disability activism is wrapped up in frameworks of acceptability. So at the same time that people are desperately trying to give voice, shed light, expose their experiences, to name what's happening to them, they're always under this excruciating pressure to do so in ways that is readily acceptable, readily usable, comfortable to the people that they're trying to like get help from. So much of making things legible is less for the needs of those that are making their experience legible and more for the comfort of those that have the resources, or the comfort of those who desperately need to be taught about these other experiences, who desperately need to have their worldview challenged and changed.
Yeah, which is much the same as many other fights for maligned, marginalized groups, where there's always that push and pull between the assimilationist drive and the drive to be fully ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And disability studies and just the landscape where these conversations are happening, it's really overt. And I think it says something about power structures in society, academia, public policy, where there's a handful of different conversations happening and the languages they use are just so divorced from each other while at the same time being inextricably linked. So we have much more radical CRIP activism, and they'll identify as like CRIP activists, CRIP theorists, who embrace a in-your-face, necessarily anti-assimilationist approach to activism and sort of policymaking. So there's a celebration of those sorts of discomfort, celebration of deviation, a celebration of alternative notions of well-being and health, and in fact, a rejection of ideals such as cure. And then you have disability studies, which right now belongs to a couple of different places. So some of it's being done in philosophy, a lot of it's being done in English departments. And that ends up looking at what literature and art can teach us about health and illness. But it ends up, at least in my experience, being a little bit more assimilative, just because it has to be dressed up for academia. It has to be shown to be useful to a liberal arts education. So it ends up having a little bit of ableness baked into it. So there's some limitations.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
It is wild to me, some of the stuff that gets done and gets talked about in disability studies in the academy, like able-bodied people writing theses on disability as representation in television, which sounds wonderful. Maybe minus the able-bodied part. Someone writing a dissertation on disability representation in modern media, wonderful, beautiful, but what they're doing then, like when you read the dissertation, is, oh, someone wants to look at disability in the television show Bones, which, okay, great, we can say a lot about how that show could be problematic, or how that show has a lot of able-minded, able-bodied people presenting stereotypes of disability. And it's like, no, they actually aren't even critical of that. They're just interested in the representation. And it's just sort of like there's something divorced there, something that's radically missing the point if what we've learned from disabled activists from the CRIP movement is nothing about us without us. And then we're doing all of this work about people without them, but we're saying that it's good work because representation is good and important, and any kind of representation is good.
This is true, I think, across the board with every marginalized group, with like trans people, with queer people, with BIPOC folks, that like, you know, a superhero being a different identity for the first time amongst mostly like white men superheroes in a franchise that is mostly propaganda for the US military, like, is not actually the slay that you think it is. You know, like, it's not actually doing anything. And, like, sure, there may be some small where just being seen in media has some small positive effect, but that's not the world we should be looking for. We shouldn't want to be in the bottom of the barrel media that, like, inherently is reproducing and reinforcing all of the worst structures of our world that we want to get rid of. We should be creating our own art, which we are.
Yeah.
But the way some people talk, that would seem not as important. What really matters is that, you know, Disney finally makes a, you know, whatever X identity princess or whatever. You know,
that we have, like, Funko Pops. Those are the things. Are they Funko Pops?
Funko Pops. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Funko Pop activism.
For every kind of identity.
Yeah. You should be able to purchase a Funko Pop that looks just like you, and then we will all be equal.
Okay. So there's a CRIP activism, disability activism, and then the kind of work that gets done that looks a lot at representation. And I'm painting really broad streaks. So there's different approaches to activism, and then there's also lots of different work being done in philosophy, but that's just a trend that I see. And then finally, you have an approach within medical ethics, which is the approach to questions of who deserves treatment and how we should treat people. And this is really where the rubber meets the road with a lot of the most important conversations as far as policy and activism are happening, because disabled people are like writing essays and protesting and just screaming, like literally screaming, like, we like living, we love living, please stop talking about us just when you want to justify killing us. And when you have people like Peter Singer writing essays about how a disabled person's life is worth less than that of an animal, justifying things like euthanasia. So that's where you have like a lot of case studies and a lot of like important policy, and where a lot of historical violences are, I shouldn't even call them historical because they're still being enacted, but where we talk about the history of eugenics and like the current practices of eugenics and grapple with it. And there's certainly not enough grappling with it. So histories of forced sterilization. You also have things like, I don't know how deep into this history we should go, because I could go on for hours about this history. Things like, there's this film that came out called The Black Stork during the turn of the century, like 1900s, where physicians were educating each other and justifying just letting disabled babies die. Just like heinous shit like that, which is still in many ways alive and well, just because the conversations that we have about bodily autonomy and about the valuation of life are just so archaic and so fraught with all of this religious baggage, but then also baggage about what a livable life is. And a livable life is always a life that is connected to an able body. And this also intersects with the way that we understand the pro-choice movement. I think also the failures of the pro-choice movement can be connected to the histories of eugenics and mm-hmm. those failures.
And then how the disability writes how the more assimilationist strands of them become caught up in questions of production, mm-hmm. where it becomes like, no, we can be productive members of society too. Like, we can contribute to capital as a way to like justify existence, rather than to say, no matter what your capabilities, even if you have no ability to contribute whatsoever, you still deserve a good life. You still deserve to be taken care of. And that underlying framework of this kind of like forced scarcity of like, who is really disabled, who really deserves it, who really needs it, means that people who are disabled are constantly under conditions of extreme poverty, are, you know, on the streets. And like, I mean, disability is famously horrifically hard to get. Like, I'll get into it more, but I just started the process of applying for disability. And the biggest thing I've heard from most people who have gone through the process is that they will always decline you no matter what. And you just need to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And just the pure punishing, like, structure of a system that says, like, if you get something that makes it so it's difficult to support yourself, that you just have to go through this, like, what could be like years long process, mm-hmm. that is so purposefully built to assume that you're like a lying monster who is just trying to, you know, feed off the government dime. And like, that narrative has been pushed, you know, across the aisle, that that's not something that is at all uniquely conservative, where there's still always this sense of need to find who truly deserves the help, mm-hmm. that the government gives.
I think Mother Jones has done a really wonderful job recently reporting on instances of children being put in foster care because their parents lacked the material means to take care of them. But then those foster parents or those agencies that they're placed in being given all of the resources that they need to accommodate those children. So we're constructing all this trauma. Like, we're not just giving people what they need to raise their children. Like, we're separating families just to be giving those same resources somewhere else. So just a punishing, cruel system. So you want to talk a little bit about your experience with disability?
Mm-hmm, for sure. I think my experience with disability and my experience with transness are kind of inextricable from each other, because, you know, growing up, like, I was in a pretty gender neutral, like, hippie household. I didn't have strong gender norms pushed on me. So it wasn't really until I was in school, and even in elementary school, it wasn't that bad. I just didn't like being separated by gender. So I didn't like sports, but I just didn't do them then. I just dropped out. And so it wasn't really until puberty that things started to be really bad. And like, one of the things about dysphoria and transness is that often, like, the rates of depression and anxiety, and I mean, like, almost any mental diagnosis that you can think of tends to be higher amongst trans people. And lots of the time, they don't necessarily go away, but they often get better upon transitions. I was diagnosed with depression. I was diagnosed with an anxiety disorder when I was, you know, relatively young. But like, who knows how much of that was just because of my pure inability to function in my own body. And then it was also like, I always dealt with a strong kind of disparateness between my abilities, where I was always good at very specific things that are hard for a lot of people, like very good at conceptual thinking, very good at writing, but also extremely struggle with some very basic things that the majority of people find quite easy and that people in general think are easy. And so therefore, the inability or being bad at those things is just looked at as lazy. And so I think the only reason I was able to get through an undergrad degree in college is just because I struggled in like some of my prereq classes that I didn't care about. Like, I really, really had a hard time. But then once I was able to get into like the higher level classes with like grad students that I really wanted to be in and in the departments that I really wanted to be in, then it just came really naturally to me and I was just able to do it, and like essays weren't hard for me and so it was whatever.
Mm-hmm. I was gonna say also those smaller class sizes, they end up being easier to accommodate different like interests and needs. I don't want to perpetuate what is, I think, somewhat of a myth, myths of different learning styles. Like, I want to be very careful about that. But like in a small classroom that's like discussion based, where you build relationships with everyone, you can be more comfortable to communicate. And then also where the instructor has a relationship with you so they can know how to push you correctly for your final projects and stuff.
Yeah, I wasn't actually diagnosed, or I didn't get a full like mental diagnosis other than anxiety and depression until the start of the pandemic. But I was diagnosed with inattentive ADHD and also sluggish cognitive tempo. And it basically confirmed everything about my life. Like, of course, looking at these tests, which are based off of like IQ tests, which are like super racist and super classist and incredibly conditional. So all of this needs to be taken with a grain of salt. But at least against those standards, I have, you know, high language skills and high conceptual thinking skills. But then my like working memory is like very low. So my ability to like look at a number and then remember it and then like tell it to someone,
oh, you know,
like
that.
Remember a phone number. And then my cognitive processing, which is like basically how fast it takes for me to look at something new that I am not extremely engaged in, and then like taking that information, is in like the second percentile. When I go to the grocery store, it takes me so fucking long to find anything because it takes so long for my like brain to perceive things. And until I was on medication, like I had a really hard time finding things. I had a really hard time having any sense of spatial awareness. Like I couldn't really tell people where things were. Like I couldn't tell you how to get somewhere. I was just kind of wherever I was at the time. And then that disparity meant that, like, you know, when I was a English teacher or I was a bookseller, I was really good at these like really specific things that were like considered difficult, conceptual thinking. But when it came to these like very baseline things that my brain wasn't fully engaged in, I was just absolutely awful at it. And it was like pulling teeth. And that's like literally how my brain works. Like literally when I do a puzzle, the less engaged I am with that puzzle, the harder it is for me. And then the more engaged I am with it, the faster and faster I get with it. And so basically the only way I was able to like be a bookseller and do that is like by some of the very specific things with like spreadsheets and stuff like that. Like I just kind of strategically pushed that work off onto other people and took other parts of work, even though I was supposed to do all of it, because there was just like no way. It took me such a long time to like see the numbers on that page and to like know what they were, you know, like just like basic quantities and stuff like that. And so it was like the actual work of like selling the books and knowing what was in the books that I was really good at, or like, you know, writing shelf talkers about why a book was good. And then I didn't really have any experience with physical disability until just this year. And I got COVID in March. And I felt like very low energy after that. But I didn't start having my main long COVID symptoms until like maybe a month and a half later. But I basically started to faint. So I've also been diagnosed with POTS, which basically means when I like stand up too quickly or like change elevation, my like blood pressure goes really low and my BPM goes up really fast and it feels terrible and I can just pass out. And then proving that was difficult. So then even though it sucked, like the first time it happened in public was kind of nice because I had like the evidence of like being in an ambulance, having my blood pressure taken and all of that. And so learning to live with that has been, you know, it's been pretty debilitating. Like all of the things I already deal with sluggish cognitive tempo, the brain fog involved with long COVID has gotten so, so much worse. I forget words all the time. The reason recording has been so difficult is some days I just cannot carry on a coherent conversation if I'm just not feeling good. In a lot more of the time than I already did, I'll just forget what I'm talking about in the middle of the sentence, and then it's harder to edit because we have to, you know, go around that. I just won't remember what I was talking about. I'm fucking tired all the time. I need a lot more sleep than I used to. POTS is literally like a disease of exertion, which means that as opposed to other things where often you want to work out, like I do need to, you know, still be active, you know, to not become too weak. But at the same time, if my heart rate goes past a certain level, my vascular system just can't fucking handle it. And then it goes to like 200 BPM. And then I feel like absolute shit for 24 hours, you know, or more.
I was going to ask, just like with my experience with long COVID, the thing that was like really scary and confusing and crazy making was that it wasn't just like an onset of symptoms that just got worse. Is that there were spikes and valleys and getting better and then being like, okay, I'm all better now, and then suddenly getting worse, or just like one symptom going away and another one showing up, and then suddenly another symptom like compounding the one that I already had, that makes you feel like totally insane. Like, and I use that word very knowingly, not to be sanist, but just to like talk about how an inability to understand and know your body can just like mess with you emotionally.
Yeah, the ability to know what's gonna happen and like definitely like planning things is so difficult, because I know that I could just be completely out of it one day. And now like if I do have a thing planned that I like really want to be fully present for, I basically like hibernate beforehand and like do nothing physical and like drink a fuck ton of water and salt, because also you're depleted of sodium because of POTS. And like that's the thing about chronic illness that's so hard, is just the complete lack of predictability. And that sometimes, like, I do feel mostly fine. I wouldn't say I feel ever back to, like, pre-COVID levels of good or of, like, energy. But definitely some days I just feel fine and I'm able to do things. And as long as I don't do anything intense physically, I'm just okay. And that's destabilizing. Mm-hmm. And then that's also the problem with disabilities and chronic illness, is proving that these things are real. Like I felt fucking crazy, you know, until I had the physical evidence that it was actually happening to me. The reason that transness and disability are so inextricable is because transness, as queerness also, have all been things that have been in the DSM. They've been pathologized. And a lot of the assimilationist move is to say, like, we're not sick, we're not disabled, we're not mad, we're this different category. But so many of us as marginalized people, we're more likely to be disabled. Mm-hmm. And also disabled people, mad people, they all deserve full autonomy and rights just as much as everybody else. And so I think a lot of the time in these pushes to want to be seen as a full autonomous adult who deserves self-determination, we try to distance ourselves from the bad ones. Like everyone does this, trans people do this, certainly, and disabled people do this, you know, like who are the bad disabled people?
The bad Crips, yeah.
Yeah, well, and I certainly think there's a problem within some of like long COVID spaces where some people who have just been disabled for the first time in their lives are, you know, not really like tapping into the fact that there are these like long histories of like activism and theory and like saying like long COVID's the worst thing ever, like
waiting for a cure.
Exactly. Yeah. And that long COVID is this particularly horrible injustice, when there are all types of disabilities and like folks who have been disabled for decades, for their whole lives, who have been doing incredible work and thinking about these things. And there needs to be a full engagement about that. And I think the thing about COVID that is scary or hard for people is that there are so many people who are finding themselves disabled for the first time. Mm-hmm. And that it's a mass disabling event. Like that's one of the things about long COVID. And it's not just, you know, like long COVID or POTS. Like it also raises the chance of a whole lot of other like autoimmune diseases. And like that's true for the flu as well, but it's significantly higher for COVID.
I have a lot of tabs that are open that I need to read that are new studies coming out about COVID and its cognitive effects. I just like can't bring myself to
tell
read
us
that.
About it.
I know that I need to read them, but I just am like struggling myself with my own experience with COVID and like with how it has affected my ability to think and to write.
I haven't read basically all year. Like, I'm still buying all of my like favorite authors'
new books
yeah. and like my friends' books and stuff. And like, I have a few books that like aren't out yet of like friends that I like haven't read yet. And I've had for like months because it's so much harder than it used to be. And it takes so much more out of me. And that is such a big struggle because reading is so tied up, you know,
your identity.
Yeah, that I'm kind of like that I'm actually very good at in a world of things that I am quite mediocre or bad at. Like, that's hard in like finding new ways to cope and to change how you navigate the world.
Mm-hmm.
What about you, Aurora? Do you want to tell us your history of disability?
How deep back into my lore do we want to go? So I study bioethics and I have a background in medical ethics, but I also grew up in a disabled household, very aware of disability. So my mother has epilepsy, and that was something that like marked my childhood and like especially my young adulthood when I had to step in more of a caretaker role. My father is bipolar, and I'm also bipolar, and his illness was something that also like marked and still marks our relationship, and I have a wonderful relationship with my father. I'm really lucky about that because he would have manic phases where he would stay awake for days and then depressive phases, and like he would do extraordinary things, but things that were definitely like marked by his illness. Like, for example, he disappeared for a year, learned how to fly an airplane, and flew a little airplane across the United States, which is like super remarkable.
Wow.
I know. He has led an amazing life. So much of it, though, I think is bound up in like in his disability and then like him understanding his relationship with it and like, I don't want to say leaning into it, but like just learning how to live with it, because like, he's been unmedicated for my youth.
But also disappearing is so hard for you and all his loved ones, right?
He didn't have very much custody over my sister and I, so he also has a criminal record, and there were issues like in our youth, like the judge said that he had to be medicated and have a job in order to see us at all. But he was unemployable mm-hmm. because of his criminal record. And so the only thing he could do to get money was to donate blood, but he couldn't donate blood while he was on his medication.
Oh my God.
Isn't that just like fucked up?
It's so fucked, yeah.
I mean, but he, and I'm really, really lucky to like gush on about my father, and I'm like very lucky again to have grown up like in a disabled household, or like say mad household. He never missed a visitation day. My stepmother is actually a psychiatric nurse, so his wife is a psychiatric nurse, but she doesn't believe in psychiatry. She's an anti-psychiatry psychiatric nurse.
Hell yeah.
She's, like, very fascinating and very cool and super supportive, and, like, she's Swiss. She works in, like, picturesque sanatoriums. That's not what they're called anymore, but that's literally what they are, like, these, like, fancy hospitals in the mountains. And she just, like, is there for her patients.
Mm-hmm.
She's been very supportive of my father and like supportive of his decision to not be medicated, but like he was in his youth in and out of psych wards beyond. And my younger sibling is autistic, and this was in the early 2000s, and that was like the peak of the autism warriors. So these like culture clashes where the anti-vax movements started taking off, and it was just like this question of how do we cure autism, but then people didn't understand autism. And again, I'm very lucky to have grown up in like a disabled med household where my mother and stepfather, for all of their faults, were at least like open and welcoming and never like pushing a cure or seeing my younger sibling as broken. It was always just like, how is the system disabling and failing to offer the right kind of resources for my autistic sibling.
Mm-hmm.
My own experience. So I'm bipolar. I actually almost didn't graduate college. So I dropped out the first time. And a lot of it was because I didn't know how to cope with the symptoms. Like, despite growing up around it and despite everything that I was reading and my history of activism, like, it's really hard to understand how to cope with things as they're happening to you. I think we're a little bit unfair to ourselves. We expect more of ourselves. Or just we ultimately don't know how to communicate with others because we think that there's something we can do to avoid what's happening to us. And that's just a really false mentality. But it's something that is just so seductive and so easy to buy into. So I was assaulted by a friend of mine and then tried to kill myself. And then I was institutionalized because of it. I think is the most succinct way I can tell that story. Something that is like super notable is that when I was taken to the ER, they actually put me in a cell. Like the ER has cells. I did not know this.
I did not know
did
this.
You know this? No. You know that ERs no. have cells? This ER had cells. Like I can't bring myself to Google and to unpack this more. Like this is just like even preparing to talk about this episode. Like, I struggled with it a lot because I don't talk about my own institutionalization very much. It's something I generally don't share. Part of it's because I struggle with what it means to be honest about what I experience while also not, like, toeing to pressure to make my experience acceptable. And then on the other hand, I don't want to be tokenized. I don't want to romanticize my experience in an unhealthy way. I don't want other people to romanticize my experience. I don't want other people to steal my experience, which is like a gross thing that happens when we share these sorts of things, is that other people like feel really entitled to our stories and our narratives. But yeah, they kept me in a cell with nothing but a bench for like over 24 hours, under 48 hours before they were able to discharge me into the psych ward. And rebuilding one's life after that experience, so it was incredibly traumatizing to be put in a cell after I tried to kill myself. I'll just say that. Just really bluntly, it was a terrible experience. And it really messes with you. Like, it fucks with you to have been pushed to a limit and then to, like, do the right thing. Like, go to the hospital. And then to be honest about, like, I did this thing or I'm living through this. And then to just be put in a position where it feels like you're being punished. I can't think of anything that's more punishing than being put in a cell with nothing but a bench and like a blanket. And they had this old poster that must have been there like since the 70s or the 80s that said that it's unlawful to be subjected to electroshock therapy without your consent.
Oh my god.
Like, and the system is terribly underfunded. And so I'm sympathetic towards people that were desperately just trying to do their job and probably thought they were doing a good thing, but these people also just did a lot of things that just made my experience worse. So for example, the nurse that came in was like really skeptical of whether or not like I was actually depressed. And I will never forget what she said to me. I quote, "All of my borderline patients come in once a month because they're cutters and they cut themselves like when they're on their period. They're just so hormonal, but it's really nothing wrong with them. They're just super hormonal. And then we just stitch them up and we let them out and then they just come back again."
Oh my god.
She said that to me.
Oh my god.
I don't know why you would say that to another human being. Also, there's so much stigma around borderline patients too. Like, they're traditionally understood as untreatable, and that's not the case actually. And the stigma that they're untreatable, hysteric women has done so much harm. And I don't have borderline. I'm not a cutter. It was just because I was a young woman that was there. And the doctor would come in and he would be annoyed because my affect was incorrect, because I like couldn't sleep and I like would be alternatively like laughing and crying hysterically. So he thought that I was faking it. And so like I think part of the reason they kept me in the cell for so long was just to see if I was faking it, which like I don't know why, like who fakes that kind of thing?
Like, if a person does that forever, like, yeah, is it even faking it? Like, well, yeah, I don't know.
And then when I was in the psych ward, there was, like, all this pressure to be doing everything correctly. So pressure to get up in the morning, to brush your teeth, to brush your hair, to take a shower, to socialize with people. And so I was doing that. And then it was always, well, you're not doing enough, or you're fine because you're doing all these things. Like, oh, you got dressed today. Oh, you put on makeup. Like, you couldn't possibly have tried to kill yourself. You couldn't possibly be depressed. And it was just, like, everything that I didn't need to hear. So it was just a very alienating and lonely experience that was also just scary because it felt punishing. So if anything, and I don't think I'm okay now. Like, I was going to joke, maybe I shouldn't joke about this, but I'm going to anyways. Like, I don't think I had a personality disorder when I went to the hospital, like when I went to the psych ward. I do think that maybe I have one now. And it's awful, like, how they treat young women and how they treat women with personality disorders. There's a woman in England, like, in the past 6 months that they let her die. She accidentally was suffocated because, like, she acted out and they thought she was faking it and they restrained her and they accidentally killed her. Like, this happens all the time.
Yeah.
Like, all these cultural, aestheticized ideas about what it means to be a mentally ill woman that only mystify or only feed into all of these stereotypes, and they're super harmful. This ties in back to the Sontag, like, metaphor of the depressed, artsy young woman, which was what I was, and about how that metaphor just, like, did so much to harm me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's interesting that people are finding power and comfort, and, like, I don't know if they're reclaiming it, though. I don't know if you can reclaim those things, or it's something that I struggle with knowing those limits.
My mom was a labor and delivery nurse, and my dad did work in mental health care as a social worker. And then my partner is a therapist and works as a school counselor. And so I've, like, had a lot of proximity to, like, these systems. And the thing about any sort of, like, diagnosis is that, like, it's always just throwing stuff at the wall to see what sticks, right? Like, misdiagnosis is rampant, and also lots of diagnoses are just kind of these, like, vague umbrellas that a lot of different things could fit under. And also, all of these diagnoses are all historically and, like, culturally contingent. Like, if you go back, we had hysteria. Like, so many of the things today were just hysteria. And also, hysteria could be something for, like, a woman that reads too much or, like, doesn't want to get married or, like,
who's a lesbian.
Yeah, or a lesbian. And so all of these things are, to go back to Foucault, our concepts of madness and what is not normal is always this moving, culturally contingent thing. And so as much as, like, I can say, like, I have ADHD, that can maybe give me some sense of, like, narrative of some people who have similar experiences, and maybe it can help me find a medication or some, or, you know, some sort of whatever that maybe helps people like me for whatever reason.
Or the insurance.
The only reason they need to exist in this diagnostic form is because we live in this fucking world of health insurance where the only way that you're able to get care is through diagnosis. And that's the reason that there's the need in the first place. And I know, like, my partner is always dealing with that kind of contradiction where, like, lots of the time kids that are having, like, a lot of problems, to get accommodations, they need to get a diagnosis. And so then you always have to weigh, what does getting X diagnosis mean for what type of accommodations they can get, like, through the resources of, like, schools to, you know, like, help them succeed? And how could it fucking hurt them? You know, like, how could that diagnosis stigmatize them in different parts of their lives and actually make their life harder? That is all something that we've made. It doesn't need to be this way.
Maybe to go back to these really broad strokes that I made, talking about disability and crip activism and the question of assimilation. So it would be amazing if we could just live outside of a system, given the ways that ableism is the thing that is disabling, or, like, transphobia is disabling, sexism is disabling, racism is disabling, but we can't separate ourselves. I think this is also ties into a really lousy reading of Butler that used to be really prominent, of if everything's performative or if everything is a construction, we can just...
Yeah, it's like, that's not what a performance means. Yeah.
So we can't just get rid of medicine and hospitals,
mm-hmm.
or pharmaceuticals and pharmaceutical companies. Like, we just can't get rid of those things. Like, that actually would cause a lot of harm in the world. But we can change our relationship with those things so it's one of harm reduction. Like, we can dispel a notion of cure to change it to living with. Like, going back to those, like you mentioned, people coping with long COVID for the first time, like the first thing that comes to mind is there's a slew of all these influencers who used to be lifestyle influencers, so just like physically beautiful, wealthy people, predominantly white, who suddenly are disabled for the first time, and it's all them just languishing and convalescing and just pining for the cure.
Mm-hmm.
Versus engaging with, again, that rich history of disability activism, or engaging with the ways in which maybe their former lifestyle, the mindset of that former lifestyle, so just the idealization of a certain kind of body, the idealization of a fitting in with a particular social class, and the aesthetics of all of that ties into what makes long COVID so debilitating.
Absolutely. Even outside of those who are currently disabled, the pre-disabled, which is everybody, can learn a lot from frameworks of disability of like, what is it about these like mindsets that we need to be entirely self-sufficient, that we need to be able to do every single thing that we're forced into because of the traumas of capitalism. We may need to find ways to survive, and we do it, but that doesn't mean that that should be the world that we strive for or what we want for each other. The world that we should want is where we are doing the things that we like take care of one another, and we're doing the things that we're like best at, and we're giving to each other like according to our own means. And that means that, like, you know, some people aren't able to contribute in the same way. And that means like also everything always goes back to abolishing capitalism, right? And that like cis heteropatriarchy and white supremacy, it's all based around this idea of like the reproducing able-bodied straight cis family that is continually able to, you know, recreate productive members. Like, we just got this new GOP House guy, and he pretty much said the thing that GOP people never want to say out loud about why they're anti-abortion, which is that abortion discourages women from creating new productive members of society. You know, it's this ownership of this future child, which is inherently an able-bodied child, inherently cis and straight, and that that's always what we're sacrificing at the altar of. It's pretty fucking grim. It's definitely, like, obviously my politics were pretty radical pre this, but I mean, I think the pandemic radicalized a lot of people who were maybe even just like lukewarm liberals to begin with, by the sense of just like complete abandonment. I just have so little capacity. If I was not lucky enough to have people in my life who can help support me, and if I wasn't lucky enough to have been able to create my little platform so I'm able to make some money, I would be really fucking struggling right now. Like, I don't know how I would be surviving. And I'm still, like I said, starting the process of applying for disability. And already it's so clear that it's built to alienate you and make you want to quit. And I have, you know, loved ones to help me with that process, and yet it's still fucking awful. So obviously, like, people with way less resources, like, it's all the more impossible. And so it's like the system isn't built to care for people. It's meant to be like a enforced disparity, because like at base, we're a eugenic country.
So much of wellness is just keeping up appearances, or at least that's my experience.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm desperately just trying to make it look like I'm holding everything together when I'm just not. And it would be nice just to get the kind of solidarity or kind of help that I needed, but in my experience, solidarity doesn't function by those with all the resources to change things suddenly changing their mind and sharing those resources. It has to do with people that are in similar positions as yours, or maybe even lower, like understanding that your well-being is connected to their well-being, and so they like give what they have, which is also nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the same circle of people passing around the same like $20.
Yeah, just for eternity. That's all mutual aid is, like the same 20 yeah. bucks.
Yeah, or I get a lot of really shitty pep talks. I mean, I get mm-hmm. better and worse pep talks. I get a lot of bootstrapping pep talks. So it's like, why do you let this happen to yourself? It's like, gee, I don't think I let this happen to me.
Yeah, that's so gross. That's the other thing is that, like, we've seen, especially since the 2020 uprising, a lot more networks of mutual aid that are quite amazing and, like, cultures of trying to support each other, but also that it shouldn't fucking be like this. Like, we live in a society, we pay taxes. It's fucking stupid that, like, all of the marginalized people are just the ones who are, like, slightly better off are paying the ones who are, like, struggling at that moment, and then vice versa, just in perpetuity, instead of just having fucking systems that actually work.
Mm-hmm.
But that would require actual redistribution of wealth and abolishing capitalism, probably. So,
yeah. And then also the the idea, as you mentioned earlier, that you have to prove your worth rather than, like, people should just, they're entitled to a nice life, I think.
Yeah. Also just how we live in bubbles, right? Like, all of my social bubbles were very pro-houseless folks. But then you go on to a site like Nextdoor, where it's all of, like, the homeowners of all of these, like, fucking huge houses. You know, a lot of them are, like, quote-unquote progressives, but it's fucking genocidal rhetoric, you know? Like, just straightforwardly evil shit. They just don't want to see it. They don't want to see the suffering that their lives are built on top of, let alone create actual help for those people.
Because people like to think that they deserve all the good things in their lives, where everyone who doesn't have those nice things deserves lesser.
Mm-hmm.
Once we recognize the degree of chance and moral luck, once we start dissolving the myth of meritocracy, and then it becomes really uncomfortable, because then you realize, like, oh shit, I didn't do anything to earn this house, or I'm not special, I'm not, like, inherently worth more than this other person. Mm-hmm. Like, that's really scary and sobering. It's a really sobering thought.
Yeah. One thing that's been really helpful for me to grapple with being chronically ill over the last year has been my other partner and daddy. He is chronically ill and, like, has been for a very long time and has, like, been in those communities. And so just giving me those reassurances, it's okay that I take care of myself and take things slowly, and that those are actually, like, necessary things for me to thrive rather than me always, like, failing myself. It's such a hard thing to get through, because there are some days where I'm just like, I can barely, you know, stand up. And, like, the few times I've, like, taken flights since this has happened, now I get, like, a wheelchair because I could just, like, faint if I, you know, am carrying my big bag all the way to the terminal. And then that weird disparity, mm-hmm, of being, like, a person that's not normally in a wheelchair, like, I'm able to walk, you know, for the most part, but, like, also, you know, maybe not. Maybe I'll just have to sit down in the middle of the floor and, like, just be fucking stuck if I tried to do it alone. And to really confront that is hard. I don't know. It's hard.
So when we think about disability, it's connected to the body. And we've begun to start, like, expanding that framework. So people have begun to be a lot more outspoken about things like ADHD or anxiety or autism. But there's, like, set narratives or kinds of expectations that come with the appropriate way of performing one's anxiety or one's autism or ADHD, or, in all honesty, also PTSD. We've talked a lot about trauma on this show. When I was an undergraduate at the University of Oregon, I used to work for the Accessible Education Center as a note taker. And a lot of the students that I worked with were veterans who had PTSD. And so the rules of this program was that the student had to be present in order for me to be paid to take notes. So if they were absent and they had to tell me, like, 24 hours beforehand, they wouldn't get the resource of the notes. But the thing about PTSD is you can't control it. Like, you can't control when you're going to get triggered. Of course, no one's going to be able to plan the trigger. And also, the trigger would be the thing that would be keeping them from coming to class. And so they would thus need the note taker to be in class while they were absent, in order for them to be able to fulfill the requirements of getting their education. But the structure was set up just so that it wasn't actually working for them. So they had to perform able-mindedness. They had to be more in control than is reasonable to expect.
Mm-hmm.
Autism is really interesting because it's becoming much less stigmatized, thank God. But we still haven't gotten rid of the good autism versus the bad autism. So recently, and by recently I mean 2014, when they came out with the DSM-5, they got rid of Asperger's and classic autism, which is like Karener is the physician, because there's two different physicians who identified the modern autism. Bauer, the eugenicist that worked with Freud, who also worked with hysterics, that was the first person to use it. But it means something else now than it did then, and certainly it means something else now than it even did with Karener and Asperger's. But there was this notion of the autistic savant, so someone that's a little bit socially awkward or like has routines that they need to have set or are really sensitive. So think figures like Rain Man or more recently Temple Grandin, but they're also secret geniuses. So we just need to take care of them in the right ways and just let their genius flourish. And then on the other hand, you have like the bad autism, and I mean bad in like the worst kind of scare quotes, like scary scare quotes, where it was someone that was nonverbal, non-functioning, who just like had all these unacceptable tics. And so you had like the good autism and the bad autism. And so like now we've gotten rid of those categories and we have the spectrum, but I don't know if we've done very much to demystify things like autism. Like I still think we have good ways of being it and then bad ways of being it, in the same way that we have like good ways of being a trauma victim and bad ways of being a trauma victim, or good ways of being anxious and bad ways of being anxious. And we need to, if we're going to get to the root of ableism, or if we're going to handle the problem of madness, then we need to be able to have those conversations to demystify.
And that, like,
those.
Let alone like frameworks for things, you know, like schizophrenia, where so many people don't even want to confront what that would mean or what it means to live in society, and that like these are our neighbors too, and that that's okay and good. And there's still often for most people this like qualifier of like, oh, those people, that's different. And which of course then feeds into the way that we think about like houseless folks, because so much of houselessness is related to mental illness.
As an instructor, like students, and I'm bracketing non-traditional students, ages 17 to like 21, 22, those are peak years for the symptoms of mental illness to suddenly become overt. And I don't just say this from my own personal experience, even though like I think my own personal experience makes me more attuned to this, but just statistically speaking, or just looking at the onset of many illnesses, that's like when they start to emerge, and then tack that on to the epidemic of sexual violence on campus, tack that on to the trauma of the pandemic that we're still in, tack that on to new traumas that emerge from laws that are coming out that are just against trans healthcare, which is constructing new kinds of trauma. Just, that's a really vulnerable bracket of people, and we don't know how to talk about it or to address them or to give them resources. Like, I just don't have resources for my students at all. And they're going through it. I mean, we're all going through it.
These battles are just so interconnected that, for instance, lots of the legislative pushes to make transition illegal and impossible are tied up in a pathologization of transness that, like, is like, oh, this, like, small group of, like, adult sane people, or like, you know, neurotypical people, like they're fine, but actually the gender ideology is taking advantage of all of these poor, you know, blank people, so like autistic people. And like, again, I think anyone that is like in trans community knows that like neurodiversity is so common amongst us, and I think that there's like interesting thinking that's being done around that, and but like it's so hard to talk about because it's used as a way to stigmatize us, that like, oh, it's just because your brain isn't working correctly, like you don't understand gender and therefore you're confused, you know? It's always this idealized, innocent child that is being, like, perverted and brought into transness, never any actual trans person, right, who is always the perpetrator. And that, again, it ties into all of these other issues, like fucking abortion, that, you know, one of the main lines against transition is this idea that our daughters are being convinced to mutilate themselves and take out their uteruses so they won't be able to reproduce with irreversible damage. Like, there's that great cover on Irreversible Damage that is honestly, like, camp. What looks like this doll, and there's just, like, a big hole, like, in the middle of her chest. And I know a lot of trans guys that have like, riffed on that in really funny ways. But that there is some ownership over breasts or over uteruses, that bodily autonomy is not something that people deserve, and that that's the fight on all of these fronts, just basic bodily autonomy.
On Instagram the other day, we asked people to tell us about how disability has affected your experience of the world. And we got tons of really great responses. And so we're going to read a big chunk of them. First one: caused agoraphobia. Don't feel safe, welcome in world, and scared of medical events in public.
Reframed how I value my time and what worth I put into what I do.
My energy became finite, limited, and much more valuable.
Being disabled affects every aspect of my life.
I always have to be vigilant when I'm out of my home to make sure I don't stumble into things that trigger my disability, and I'm pretty much always constantly masking how much pain I'm in.
Makes you more considerate of everyone else.
Perpetually knowing the world's not made for me.
Wheelchair user here, lack of freedom and independence, otherness unwanted on display.
All of the ways it can be harder to walk somewhere because of someone's obliviousness. Nobody shoveled, cars blocking ramps or sidewalks, heavy doors, a constant.
I think being a mech engineer comes in handy, problem solving and adapting, but it's exhausting too. Some inequalities are too ingrained to adapt my way out. I need more time always in planning and implementing just to enjoy things that were easy before. But I also take more joy in the littler things. Intentional rests look so different. The more I learn about my disability, the more I understand myself, past and present.
I developed OCD as a way to maintain control after I lost all control. That's honestly been harder.
FOMO of big moments, relationships, community, gatherings, body feels like a cage.
Long COVID, continuing to be COVID cautious has led to a form of segregation for my life.
I forget it's there until it pops into existence, creates a scene, and makes me feel ashamed.
The expectation that most people won't understand how I feel about certain things, so I have the tendency to over-explain, over-rationalize everything I feel.
Ironically, it made me less suicidal out of spite. So much anger and need for change driving me.
I can't take part in life as much, as often as I want to. I miss out on a lot, and I get left behind.
My disability is invisible, and people fade soon after I disclose.
Especially with the pandemic, it is clear to me how many on the left are actually eugenicists.
I'm hard of hearing, which means I need to pay stupid amounts of money to be able to hear.
Makes me miss my life pre-COVID, took my ability to study properly and work hospital jobs, simultaneously being left out and central to every movement struggle, ultimate gaslighting.
I found profound acceptance and empowerment.
I feel utterly alienated from everyone and spend so much effort trying to not to be a problem.
I'm a firm believer that my impairment does not disable me. What disables me is the blatant ableism and general lack of accessibility I regularly and systematically experience. Being disabled and dipping my toes into disability studies has made me acutely aware of a lot of fucked up shit that functions to other me, but through the disability community, I found profound acceptance and empowerment.
My disabilities are invisible, and I feel people often assume badly of me.
Do you want to read this really long one?
Sure. Too much to even begin to cover in a question box like this helps me be more empathetic and creative, but also exposes the absolute lack of solidarity and widespread nature of straight eugenics-like logic of society. Most people won't see me as a person. I can't go anywhere without attracting unwanted attention, even more than when I was just visibly queer or trans. And that's without considering how much of society I am now literally locked out of due to systemic ableism and specifically the rejection of pandemic safety by even self-proclaimed leftists. Also able to experience the world and environment just for what it is and not through a framework of capitalist Protestant work ethic shit. I'm unable to even begin to live up to those standards, and so I have never viewed them as natural or reasonable or inevitable. Existing is valuable enough. There doesn't need to be a purpose.
All right, that's it for this week. Thanks for coming down memory lane with the two of us on our little paths of disability, and have a happy Halloween. If you would like to support our work, we are at www.patreon.com/drunkchurch. And you can sign up at different tiers for access to bonus episodes and a Discord and other cool stuff. As always, the majority of our episodes are free to the public. And I hope you all have a very spooky rest of your day.
Happy Halloween and God bless.
Happy Halloween and God bless.
Bless you for being an angel, just when it seemed that heaven was not for me. Bless you for building a new dream, just when my old crumbled so helplessly. In that vine-covered chapel on the hill, your face was a hymn that lingers still. So bless you, my darling, my angel. Heaven is mine and life is divine with you.
Bless you, darling, for being an angel, just when it seemed that heaven was not for me. Bless you for building a new dream, just when my old dream crumbled so helplessly.
In that vine-covered chapel on the hill, your face was a hymn that lingers still. So bless you, my darling, my angel. Heaven is mine.